Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest today is Wheeler Winston Dixon. He is the James Ryan Professor of Film Studies, coordinator of the Film Studies Program, and professor of English at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. We're talking about his latest book. It's a collection of essays, Synthetic Cinema, the 21st Century Movie Machine. Wheeler, it is such a pleasure to talk to you again. You're my number one go-to person to talk about film.
Hey, Mark, I appreciate it.
The art of film, I should say. The art
of
film.
Well, film in all respects.
Let's first address COVID because, you didn't write about this in this book, but there was just the announcement that all the new releases are going to be released immediately to premium channels.
Well, that's from Warner Brothers. And Warner Brothers, first they did it cautiously saying we're going to make Wonder Woman 1984 available. But then they announced that their entire slate was going to open on HBO Max and in theaters the same day.
So what is this going to do to movie theaters?
Movie theaters are pretty much over. I mean, I was reading a long piece by an epidemiologist who was basically saying if you think you're going to go back to normal soon, you're crazy, because even when the vaccine becomes available, 40% of the populace doesn't want to take it. And so therefore, even if you're vaccinated, you're still going to have to wear a mask. You'll still be at risk in an auditorium. So they don't think that there's any way that it's going to get back to normal before, say, 2023.
Whoa.
Yes. So I think that it looks very bleak for theaters right now, because this collapses what is called the theatrical window.
Yeah.
In other words, they would become available first in theaters, and then after, it used to be 6 months, then it was 6 weeks, and now it's the same day and date. And of course, the theaters are all furious, but it's the right thing to do. So
what about small art house theaters?
Well, small art house theaters are just as contagious as huge.
But they could institute something where you have to show a card. Proof of vaccination.
Well, to tell you, one thing that happened last night, we got to see a great film, Nomadland, which is by Chloe Zhao.
Yep.
And that was playing at the New York Film Festival at Lincoln Center. But one of the upsides of the pandemic, if there is such a thing, is the fact that we saw it, you know, by subscription streaming last night. We were able to see that, whereas we would not be able to see that, you know, before, because we'd have to go to New York City because they're only playing in one theater, the Walter Reed. But now, since this is all streaming, I think that art house films have a better chance to be streamed, and they're not going to be obliterated by the Marvel DC behemoth, which basically is what's happening right now at the multiplexes.
We got to talk about your book.
Okay, talk about the book.
And then we'll dovetail back to what we're talking now.
Okay.
I want a definition of synthetic cinema since you just started to talk about it.
Well, synthetic cinema is cinema that's made solely for the purpose of making money. It has no real emotion. It has no real passion. There's no real characters. There's nothing in it that's real. There's no battles. There's nothing at stake. There's nothing that is genuinely human about it. And also, it takes extensive use of CGI, computer-generated imagery. And that's really the definition of Marvel movies. You have Titanic battles where nothing is really won or lost. And when people die in synthetic cinema, they're always ready to be reborn somehow. And synthetic cinema is long, crushingly loud, and supposed to be satisfying, but it's sort of like a Big Mac. It has no nutritional value.
So people do enjoy these films, though. You have to admit. I mean, I know people that love these films. I wrote to you about this. I avoid these films, obviously. And I set about to watch the whole Avengers thing and all the related films.
Oh, dear God.
Over the course. It's COVID. What are you going to do?
Well, I think there's lots of art.
Well, I watch those all the time anyways. So I decided, because my son, 50 years old, he is a major comic collector, and he...
Of course.
And his kids, he brings them to all the... his son, especially.
The Comic-Cons and things like that.
Well, he doesn't do the Comic-Cons, but he brings them to the movies. And my youngest grandson loves the Marvel DC Universe. So I set about to watch...
Well, it's for kids. Why not?
Yeah, well, I set about to watch them. And the biggest thing, I guess, you're right about all the other points you made. There's no there. There's no contact to reality. And
they're all the same.
Well, it just becomes the same. I think in the beginning it was sort of a novelty. Now when you get down to the 11th, 12th, and 13th films or whatever, what can you do to make it new? And it's just a lot of big action and, like, you know, colossal this.
But it's pretty dull in the end, don't
you?
Yeah,
and I have...
I mean, there's really nothing happening on the screen. I mean, who cares? Somebody smashes somebody else and somebody else crashes somebody else.
Well, I think the worst example of these is the Transformers, maybe. That might be...
Oh, well, the Transformer films, that's Michael Bay. So that's off the top. I mean, Michael Bay is just, you know, he's not even a director. He's sort of, you know, a traffic cop.
Well, I mean, and here's my take on this, and I wrote to this. I actually think the comics are better than the movie. In the sense that there's not so much money thrown at them, and it's not such a huge business. It is a big business. The commercial comics are not the independent comics, which I'll defend to my dying breath.
Sure, sure.
But I actually believe the comics are better and more contained. After a while, you just felt like you're getting beaten up.
The thing about it is that comic book movies have always been with us. I mean, as I say in the book, they started out with serials on Saturday morning, and that's where you first saw
Batman.
And
I end up seeing
Superman.
Some of those 1940s Batman serials.
And those things were for kids. And these are for kids. But they were at the margins, not the mainstream. Now they're at the mainstream, and they've dumbed down everything else. So that's basically the problem, is that the people expect these films because there's nothing else that they can see easily. I mean, when I was growing up, there were, you know, Bergman films, Fellini films, Truffaut films, Godard films, readily available in theaters. And now, of course, they're not. It's just a niche thing. But that's, going back to my original point, the interesting thing to me about the pandemic is now that these $200 million films are no longer going to be able to make their money back. I mean, you're saying that Warner Brothers is going to have their entire slate go out to theaters and streaming at the same time, but these films cost $200 million apiece, and they're not going to make that back. So the thing is that this is an unsustainable economic model. And the other thing that I did an interview with the LA Times recently about this, the other thing is that once upon a time, they had, you know, you have a mega picture, and it has 3,000, 4,000 theaters to open in.
Yeah.
Now it's only got three possibilities, you know, HBO, Netflix, maybe Amazon or something like that. And it's not possible for it to make back its money, reach that kind of an audience.
Except everything, including the actors, will be CGI.
God help us, yes.
Because that's already happened. That's already happened.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course. It happened a long time ago. First film was the Final Fantasy, and it goes on like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's where this is going. I think we're eventually going to have AI-generated films.
Well, of course. I mean, I think we've already got that. But I dread that day, because then everything that is human will be erased from the screen. I mean,
well, wait a minute.
For example,
independent filmmakers are always going to make independent films. And I think points of one of your essays is, where do we go now to see those films? I mean, these interesting independent cinema is never going to go away.
We go online. Everything is going to be online. That's my point. I don't think theatrical is coming back. Theatrical will come back as a niche thing, you know, museums and places like that. Museum of Modern Art, for example, in New York is open right now, but at 25% capacity. Still, that's insanely risky.
Yeah,
you know, and they're having, you know, huge spikes there. But we're going to be seeing this stuff online, just like Nomadland that we saw last night online, which is a beautiful film by Chloe Zhao. Frances McDormand is fantastic in the title role. But I think we're going to see these things online. People will be making small-budget films. Another person who is going to succeed is Jason Blum, who is the head of Blumhouse.
Mm-hmm.
Horror movies, of course, incredibly popular. And what do they cost? $20-30 million. So basically, for example, David Fincher's new film, Mank.
Yeah.
Right? That had a budget of only $20-30 million. That's going to make it back on Netflix, because everybody just signed in, bam, and the thing just makes its money in one screening. So I think there's going to have to be a scaling down. And these films are very still expensive to make, the CGI spectacles. So,
oh, yeah.
Anyway, so next.
Yeah, you have an interesting anecdote, and I just want you to talk about it in your book. Of many that are in your book, and I want to recommend this book. First of all, it's I love books that cause you to want to talk about it, and this is one of those books.
It's definitely a polemic.
Yeah, it is. You get up on your high horse and on that soapbox, and you go for it, boy.
Well, I don't know about the high horse, but it's more or less, you know, railing from the front.
Oh, you are.
Yeah.
You have a
yeah.
great anecdote about Freddie Francis and David Lynch making movies together.
Yeah, yeah.
And talk about that, because that sort of sums up the problem right there.
Well, Freddie was a very dear friend of mine from 1984 when I called him up, cold called him, and said, look, I'd like to come and watch you shoot your movie, next latest movie in London. And he invited me over, and it was great. And we became good friends and stayed that way for a long time. I made a movie in Los Angeles. He provided the crew. That was a different story. But he basically wanted to make movies that were very tactile with people on the set. He liked to work with the actors on the set. He just couldn't stand doing the whole thing long distance. And the first time he made a film like that was with Martin Scorsese, which was Cape Fear.
Oh, yeah.
And they did the whole thing with monitors. They were never on the set at all. And he just thought this was just a terrible way to make movies. So the last thing that he made, the last film that he made, and I was on the set for that, was The Straight Story.
Love that movie.
It's a beautiful film. Yeah,
that's a great movie.
David Lynch's finest.
Yeah.
And it was shot in 15 days in Iowa. And so I zoomed over to Iowa and hung out with him and the crew and stuff. And it was all done naturally. There's no special effects. And it was just the kind of perfect movie. But when he was making his first film with David Lynch, that's the story, The Elephant Man, it was all done on the floor. And at the end of every day, they'd say, that's the stuff that's going to be in the movie. But the next film was Dune. And that was the first version of Dune. The special effects were very clumsy. And they had to hold the camera in one place so they could do all the green screen and blue screen stuff. And it was, you have no idea what's really in the film. And he said, that's it. That's the last time I'm doing a special effects film. Because he really believes very much in the real as opposed to the synthetic.
Well, it is a weird process, and as you described to me, it really came home when you're making a special effects film.
You don't know what you've got.
You're just sort of looking at actors against the green screen, and hoping the special effects team, which is usually huge, are do their work and it comes out okay. But you're no longer the auteur of the film.
You know, most of the time, the actors are reacting to nothing or like a cardboard box which is being dragged. I mean, believe it or not, it's true. In some of the films, they just use a cardboard box dragged along by a string to suggest a monster, which is going to be in the shot. I'm not making that up. It's true. You know, anything at all, because they're just going to substitute it.
God. Also, as I was mentioning, there used to be the concept that the director was the auteur, and that was especially true during the Cahiers du Cinéma period, where they were talking about the theory of the auteur of cinema. Hitchcock
right,
is a good
director is a primary
right. Hitchcock is a good example. Yeah. Truffaut, Godard,
oh, the name above the title director. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Where they actually did care about the totality of the film.
They had the last word. I mean, they had final cut, and that's something that's just gone away completely. I mean, now directors are just being, as I say in the book, fired from movies halfway through if they're not adhering to the Marvel universe or the DC universe or whatever.
It's just a job. You can be replaced.
Yeah, you're just hired guns. But the thing that's funny is Michael Bay, to go back to a horrifying example, actually has an investment in the Transformer characters and thinks that it's fascinating. So he never is going to get into trouble because he's totally wired into that. But other directors who have something of substance to say, they find that they're just being, you know, thrown off the set and just replaced. I mean, you know, they don't hit it. Now it's the producers. And, of course, the risks are so enormous now that for these huge movies, they use multiple studios, you know, combinations of studios, because one bad movie can sink the entire studio. And the studios also, that's another point, have become obsolete because now it's the streaming services that really run everything. Everything's moved online. You know, buying stuff, seeing stuff, listening to music, books, everything. So.
You talk about a problem of visual quality, too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, the thing is that I had a screening of my films in Los Angeles just before the whole thing crashed at the Steven Spielberg Theater in Los Angeles. And seeing them on a screen, beautifully projected, one person in the audience said, I've seen your stuff on Vimeo, but to see it on a screen projected like this, it's just mind-blowing, such a totally different experience.
Yeah.
And I absolutely agree. But unfortunately, that's an experience which is going to become absolutely, I mean, I can't remember the last time I was in a movie theater. You know, it was more than a year ago.
Well, the problem is the audiences have gotten more annoying, too, because they don't know how to behave in a movie theater.
No, I mean, as a matter of fact, the last film we were at, they were opening up their laptops during the film.
Yep, yep.
And on the phone. And also the theaters are filthy, and they run 30 minutes worth of trailers at the beginning at blast level. So by the time it gets to the movie, you're exhausted.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Wheeler Winston Dixon. He is the James Ryan Professor of Film Studies, coordinator of the Film Studies Program, and professor of English at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln.
Emeritus now. We got to put that in there.
Because
I'm an emeriti now. I retired.
So you're the
just before the pandemic hit.
Oh, is that good or bad?
It's great.
Oh, okay.
It's fabulous. No, it's perfect. It's perfect. Okay. The timing was supernatural. So.
And we're talking about his latest book, Synthetic Cinema, the 21st Century Movie Machine. Now, this is another thing I want to talk about, and you talk about this at end in one of your essays. We don't have movie criticism in the way that we used to, or it's
gone.
It's gone. I mean, it's been replaced by what, Rotten Tomatoes?
Yeah, well, the thing is, you know, why read a review when you can just look at a number? You know, I mean, well, you know, Rotten Tomatoes, 93% like it? Oh, okay. You know, 23% like it? You know, well, I think we'll skip it.
And movie criticism for people who never read, I mean, some movie criticism from the 40s and the 50s, the great writers, you still read that criticism today. Because
James
it's
A.G., Harris, Pauline Kael, you know, the people who were really serious about film and who would, you know, write thoughtful, long, detailed, you know, essays on it. I mean, you know, treating them with real respect. But, of course, the films at that point were of a much higher quality, too, I really do believe, except for the films where you have no money, so you can take whatever chances you want to. And those are the films that are the most interesting, the ones that come from the margins. But yeah, film criticism is really dead. And also, Film Comment magazine, which is one of the United States, right? It's folded. Did you know that?
No.
It doesn't exist anymore. The best, for all the listeners out there who would like to hear some really good film criticism, there is an Australian website called Senses of Cinema. And that's really the last bastion of really intelligent film criticism that's available, either in print or on the web, you know, today. I mean, it's run by a bunch of graduate students, but they pull in the top people in the field, and it's really a fascinating journal. So Senses of Cinema, I highly recommend, but you can't find intelligent film criticism in newspapers or in journals. You know, it's just gone. They're just reviews. There's a difference between daily reviewing and really thoughtful analysis.
It really is. Is part of the problem, and the more I thought about your essays, I really think the film problem is part of a larger problem of education in the arts in this country.
It's gone.
Yeah.
It's gone.
It's like at the high school level, you should be starting to educate people not about necessarily how to do, but how to think about how to criticize.
Well, I started making movies in high school, and you know, I know a lot of other people did too. But what I'm saying, what we're both saying here is that there is not the support for the arts that there used to be. You used to have high school orchestras. You used to have, you know, art programs, art departments. And now everything has become STEM. And the problem with that is, and STEM is necessary. We need to have scientists and mathematicians and physicists and things like that, doctors. But there is not an appreciation for the arts. It's really just a matter of it's really also about the fact that it's so expensive to live these days.
Oh, yeah.
So people are just, you know, saying, well, I've got to do something that's going to make me money. And let's face it, most people who are actors or directors and stuff don't make enough money to live. And so that, you know, it's basically a thing where a few people rise to the top, but there's many more people who are, you know, still working along on the bottom.
It's really funny how the profit motive has really sort of risen to the top. When I was in high school, and I don't want to even tell you the dates, but it was in the 60s. You never thought about that. That didn't creep into the conversation at all.
No. And the thing is that there was always the option that you could, you know, have a middle-range job and be perfectly okay and comfortable, you know, not rich but comfortable. And now, of course, we're in the age of, you know, the giant conglomerates. I mean, Amazon is an astounding story. I mean, here's a guy who started off just selling used books on the web. And now he has, you know, fulfillment centers all around the country, and he's one of the richest persons on the face of the earth. It's you know, and everybody has to, but everybody has to buy from Amazon now because it's not safe to go to the store. You know, that's the other thing. It's not safe to go out to the movies, go to the store. So you stream, you buy books, things like that. It's a whole different economy.
I have a theory, and I just want to hear your words on it. I have a theory that these big budget, large action movies are being done because everybody's watching film now on their phone. And big action translates well to a tiny screen.
You really think so?
I think one of the reasons this whole trend is going the way it is because people don't even watch films on their TV anymore. People watch them on their iPad and their phone. I mean,
yeah,
it's always amazing to me to watch people watch films on their phone.
Because that blows my mind because, I mean, you know, one of my students, when I, you know, did my last class, was watching 2001 on a cell phone. You know, and I was just thinking, really? Honestly? that's really your idea of a wonderful time? You know, and so, you know, I said, so what's next? Lawrence of Arabia? I mean, you know, really, it's just appalling. So, yeah, I mean, that kind of stuff is just, it's like shooting fish in a barrel.
But it's one of the reasons, because then it translates into all formats, and therefore it'll be a much more successful film. I mean, that's one. I have to believe that's one of the reasons they're doing these big action movies. It's like, first of all, and you don't need to pay attention.
But also,
so you can watch them while you're in the class listening to your lecture.
Yeah, well, and they're video games. Well, yeah, well, that's one of the things that when I was teaching my classes in the last years, I would sit way in the back because I was teaching a large auditorium of about like 100 people.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, you know, no, and we would run them on a huge screen and everything like that. But I would sit in the back so I could see if anyone
was on
their laptop and stuff. And then I'd go down and I'd say, like, shut that thing off, you know, and so, you know, try to police things. But I just can't understand, you know, how here's a fantastic movie on the screen. Oh, but I'd rather go shopping, you know, so, no.
That's actually great that you did that. I'm pleased as punch that you did that. There's so many things I want to talk about from these essays, and they're just little sub things that I learned that I never knew existed. Talk to me about the work of the company called Flawless.
Oh, Flawless. Well, Flawless is a scream. Flawless basically is if you shoot something and you don't like it, you just send the footage to Flawless, and you can see a Flawless demo on Vimeo, and. But they'll do is they'll just fix it. I mean, they'll just basically, you know, fix the background, fix the color of your lipstick, remove little imperfections in your face. And the demo that they have is an actress who says, you know, you've been looking at the after of me the whole time. Now here's before. And she slaps her fingers. You can see the crow's feet, you know, and you can see the circles under her eyes, you know. And she says, I am a human. Nobody's perfect, you know, but you want perfection, so send it to Flawless. You know, and so it basically it's just, you know, you just completely, you know, and for example, in The Irishman, Scorsese's famously spent, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars to de-age De Niro and Pesci, you know, but not very effectively, but Flawless does a very good job with that. So Flawless is if your stuff isn't just right, absolutely perfect, send it to Flawless and they'll make it. Also in the demo, she says, you know, we do this routinely for, you know, all of the actors who work in these films, but we can't obviously show that or tell that because that's a confidentiality thing. But nearly, you can just take it for granted that nearly everything you see on the screen these days in a commercial, mainstream Hollywood movie, all the actors have been flawless.
Oh, my God.
So that's another example of synthetic cinema. So that completely eliminates the real. You're not looking at a real person there. You're looking at an interpretation of a person.
Well, it's interesting. The film that you just mentioned that you saw with Frances McDormand.
Yeah.
I've seen stills from the film. I haven't seen the film yet.
Beautiful film.
And
she
looks natural.
That's a very low-budget indie. But here's the interesting thing to me about that. Chloe Zhao, at the same time she was making that, and shot on location in Nebraska and in Arizona, she was in pre-production for a Marvel movie, Eternals, which is going to open sometime in 2021, maybe.
But
for
essentially,
a $200 million budget.
Yeah, isn't that going to pay the bill so that she can make the other movie?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I have nothing wrong. I don't see anything wrong with that so long as you make the first movie, and then I'll never see the Eternals, and I have no interest in it. But I'm sure
it's their best one yet.
I'm sure it's the best one. Yeah, absolutely. You know, make me something just like the other one, except slightly different, right? I mean, that's
I was just trying to suck you into it.
It's sort of like, yeah, this sort of like, you know, the same, please. You know, I'll have the same.
That's a fact. And when I read that, and you're right, the people are saying that in their head or in their heart or in their mind.
We
or
don't
something.
Want surprises.
Well, that's I think that's a product of our culture right now. I mean, when you look at 2020, I think people just want to eat, you know, mac and cheese. I mean, it's like...
Well, Well, sure. I mean, the thing is, you know, that's why everything is now the same. And I think people, trailers now, for example, tell the whole story in a movie. They don't just, you know, it used to be like a few scenes, like, you know, never before, such thrills, these great stars, blah, blah, blah. And now it's like, you know, in a world where this happens, and that happens, and this happens, and that happens. And the next thing you know, you're giving away the entire plot of the film. So I'm sitting there saying, well, thank you very much.
I know, it's like the Cliff Notes to the movie.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
Oh, my God. You also talked about, and I remember this well, you used the example of Jean Cocteau, poet and movie maker. There were people who would actually give money to the arts, to people making independent films. Yeah. Jean Cocteau, and people have never seen Cocteau's movies. They're freaking magical.
I know. But yeah, I mean, really, Blood of a Poet, Orpheus, Testament of Orpheus.
Testament of Orpheus has got famous people in it.
Testament of Orpheus has got Pablo Picasso in it. Yeah, I mean, I wrote an article about it recently. I'll try to look it up while we're talking. But anyway, yeah, I mean,
his Beauty and the Beast
is gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous.
And it's so funny to compare that to the Disneyfication.
I know. I just the Disney film, I couldn't bear to look at it, to tell you the truth. I mean, it's just really.
But he was financed.
Yeah, well, the thing about the Testament of Orpheus was that he was 70 years old at the time, wanted to make a movie, and had no money at all. So he basically, Francois Truffaut, who just made his first film, The 400 Blows, gave him $100,000, which he just won, and then got the participation of all these various different actors to appear in the film. And it was made more or less as a patronage thing. Cocteau's first film, Blood of a Poet, was
I love that movie.
A patronage thing. Yeah, it's a great, great film.
That's a definition of surrealist cinema, by the way, is that and Inchinadlu.
Yeah, absolutely.
Those are, and if you, and they're not long movies, but they're absolutely amazing movies.
Yeah, they're magical. They're magical.
Yeah, it's like nothing you've ever seen before. I mean, it's still shocking every time that scene comes up in Inchinadlu. I don't care how many times you've seen it; it still freaks you out.
Well, the other thing about Cocteau is that I ran his films in my classes, and he always speaks to the young.
Yeah, I mean, that's right.
He still managed that they're just always really impressed. Here, I've pulled up this article. I'm looking for the people who were in it. He had Charles Aznavour, Ricky Bargeau, Yul Brynner, Jean Marais, Maria Casares, Serge Lafargue, Pablo Picasso, Roger Vadim, Annette Stroyberg, and cast himself in the lead role. Was made for $100,000.
Jean Marais, one of the great faces of cinema. Marais is like no. Marais and Orfeu is one of the great men.
I was lucky enough to correspond with him before.
Oh, no, Wheeler, we're out of time. We're out of time.
Goodbye, Mark.
We have to come back and just talk again. I haven't even gotten to one page. My returning guest today is Wheeler Winston Dixon. He is the Emeritus James Ryan Professor of Film Studies, Coordinator of the Film Studies Program and Professor Emeritus Professor of English at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. And as you can see from the way that we're talking, he writes really good about film. We're talking about his latest book, a collection of four really great, thought-provoking essays, Synthetic Cinema, the 21st Century Movie Machine. Wheeler, we'll talk again.
Thank you, Mark. It's always a pleasure.
Oh, man, it's always a pleasure.
It goes so fast.
I know. You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.